In this last episode on the Crusades, we take a brief look at the 5th through the 7th Crusades and then an analysis of the Crusades as a whole. The day set for the start of the 5th Crusade was June 1st of 1217. It was Pope Innocent III's long dream to reconquer Jerusalem. He died before the Crusade set off, but his successor, Honorius III, was just as ardent a supporter. He continued the work begun by Innocent. The armies that were sent out accomplished much of nothing, except to waste a lot of lives. Someone came up with the brilliant idea that the key to conquering Palestine was to secure a base in Egypt first. You may remember that had been the plan for the Fourth Crusade. The Crusaders now made the major port of Damietta their goal. After a long battle, the Crusaders took the city, for which the Muslim leader Malik al-Kamil offered to trade Jerusalem and all Christian prisoners that he held. The Crusaders thought that the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II was on his way to bolster their numbers, and so they rejected the offer. Problem was, Frederick was not on the way. So in 1221, Damietta reverted to Muslim control. Frederick cared little about the Crusade. After several false starts that revealed his true attitude towards the whole thing, the emperor decided that he'd better make good on his many promises and set out with 40 galleys, but only 600 knights. They arrived in Acre in September of 1228. Because the Muslim leaders of the Middle East were once again at odds with each other, Frederick convinced the aforementioned al-Kamil to make a decade-long treaty that turned Jerusalem over to the Crusaders, along with Bethlehem, Nazareth, and the pilgrim route from Acre to Jerusalem. On March 19th of 1229, Frederick crowned himself by his own hand in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. This bloodless assumption of Jerusalem infuriated Pope Gregory IX, who considered control of the Holy Land and the destruction of the Muslims as one and the same thing. And so the church never officially acknowledged Frederick's accomplishments. He returned home to deal with internal challenges to his rule, and over the next decade and a half, the condition of Palestine's Christians deteriorated, and badly. Everything gained by the treaty was turned back to Muslim hegemony in the fall of 1244. The last two crusades, the 6th and the 7th, center on the career of the last great crusader, the King of France, Louis IX. Known as Saint Louis, he combined the piety of a monk with the chivalry of a knight, and he stands in the front rank of all-time Christian rulers. His zeal revealed itself not only in his devotion to religious ritual, but in his refusal to deviate from his faith, even under the threat of torture. His piety was genuine, as evidenced by his concern for the poor and the just treatment of his subjects. He washed the feet of beggars, and when a monk had warned him against carrying his humility too far, he replied, quote, "If I spent twice as much time in gambling and hunting as in such services, no one would find fault with me," unquote. Well, the sack of Jerusalem by the Muslims in 1244 was followed by the fall of the Crusader bases in Gaza and Ashkelon. In 1245, at the Council of Lyon, the Pope called for a new expedition to once again liberate the Holy Land. Though King Louis lay in a sickbed with an illness so grave that his attendants at one point put a cloth over his face, assuming that he was dead, he rallied and took up the Crusader cross. 3 years later, he and his French brother princes set out with 32,000 troops. A Venetian and Genovese fleet carried them to the island of Cyprus, where large-scale preparations had been made for their supply. They then sailed to Egypt. Damietta fell again, but after this promising start, the campaign turned into a disaster. Louis's piety and benevolence were not backed up by what we might call solid skills as a leader. He was ready to share suffering with his troops, but didn't possess the ability to organize them. Heeding the counsel of several of his commanders, he decided to attack Cairo instead of Alexandria, a far more strategic goal. The campaign was a disaster, with the Nile being choked with the bodies of slain crusaders. On their retreat, the king and the Count of Poitiers were taken as prisoners. The Count of Artois was killed, and Louis himself was captured. The humiliation of the crusaders had rarely been so steep. Louis's fortitude shone brightly while suffering the misfortune of being held captive. Threatened with torture and death, he refused to renounce Christ or yield up any of the remaining crusader outposts in Palestine. For the ransom of his troops, he agreed to pay 500,000 livres, and for his own freedom gave up Damietta and abandoned the campaign in Egypt. Clad in garments given by the Sultan, in a ship barely furnished, the king sailed for Acre, where he ended up staying 3 years, spending huge sums on fortifications at Jaffa and Sidon. When his mother, who was acting as the queen regent in his absence, died, Louis was forced to return to France. He set sail from Acre in the spring of 1254. His queen, Margaret, and the three children born them in the East returned with him. So complete a failure might have been expected to destroy all hope of ever recovering Palestine. But the hold of the crusading idea upon the mind of Europe was still strong. Popes Urban IV and Clement III made renewed appeals, and Louis once again set out. In 1267, with his hand on a crown of thorns, he announced to his assembled nobles his purpose to go a second time on a holy crusade. In the meantime, news from the East had been of continuous disaster at the hand of Mohammedan enemies. That's what the Muslims were called at that time. And of discord among the Christians at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. In 1258, 40 Venetian vessels engaged in battle with a Genovese fleet of 50 ships off Acre with a loss of 1,700 souls. A year later, Templars and Hospitallers held forth in a pitched battle, not with the Muslims, but with each other. And then in 1268, Acre, greatest of the Crusader ports, fell to the Muslim Mamluks. Louis set sail in 1270 with 60,000 into disaster. Their camp was scarcely pitched on the site of ancient Carthage on the north coast of Africa when a plague broke out. Among the victims was the king's son, John Tristan, born at Damietta. And King Louis himself died. His body was returned to France and the French army disbanded. By 1291, what remained of the Crusader presence in the Holy Land was finally uprooted by Muslim control. Those more familiar with the history of the Crusades may wonder why I've neglected to mention the disastrous Children's Crusade of 1212. That was inserted between the Fourth and the Fifth Crusades. And the reason that I've decided to mostly skip it is because historians have come to doubt the veracity of reports about it. It seems now more apocryphal than real, conflated from several disparate reports of groups that wandered around southern Europe looking to hop onto a campaign to recapture Jerusalem. The story goes that a French or German child of 10 years had a vision in which he was told to go to the Middle East and convert the Muslims by peaceful means. As he shared this vision and began his trek to Marseille, other children joined in his cause, along with some adults of dubious reputation. As their ranks swelled, they arrived at the French coast, expecting the seas to part so that they could make their way over to the Middle East on dry land. Never mind that it was a trip of hundreds of miles. Unsurprisingly, the waters failed to part, and the children, most of them anyway, ended up dispersing. Those who didn't were rounded up by slavers who promised to transport them to the Holy Land free of charge. But of course, once they were aboard ship, they were captives and were hauled to foreign ports all over the Mediterranean where they were sold. Turns out, human trafficking has a long history. While the Children's Crusade has been considered a real event for many years, it's recently come under scrutiny and doubt as records of the time were examined more closely. It seems it's more a product of cutting and pasting various stories that took place right around that time. The children were, in fact, bands of Europe's landless poor, who had nothing better to do than wander around southern France and Germany, waiting for the next crusade to be called so that they could go and hopefully participate in the plunder of what they'd been told were rich eastern lands, but were in fact, by that time, war-weary and impoverished. I now offer some commentary on the Crusades. For centuries, Christians have tried to forget the Crusades, but critics and skeptics are determined to keep them a hot issue. Jews and Muslims have, most rightly I think, used the Crusades as a point of complaint. In more recent times, new atheists like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, have wielded the Crusades like a crowbar and beaten Christians over the head with them. Isn't it interesting that these God deniers have to first assume biblical morality to then deny it? If they were consistent with their own atheistic beliefs, they'd have to find some other reason to declaim the Crusades than that it's wrong to indiscriminately kill people. according to their Darwinist evolutionary survival of the fittest motif, shouldn't they applaud the Crusades? After all, according to their way of thinking at progress, they were advancing the cause of evolution by getting rid of weaker elements of the race. But no, the new atheists don't use this line of reasoning because it's simply abhorrent. Instead, they have to first don a belief in Christian morality to attack Christianity. Talk about being hypocritical. And let's get our facts straight. The 20th century saw more people killed for secular and materialist political and ideological reasons than all previous centuries combined. Between the communists, Nazis, and fascists, well over 100 million were killed. Stalin, Hitler, and Mao Zedong were motivated by an atheistic agenda, one rooted in a social application of Darwinism. Karl Marx, the ideological father of communistic socialism, applied Darwin's evolutionary ideas to society and turned human beings into mere parts of a vast machine called the state. Anyone deemed a cog instead of a gear was to be removed so the machine could run as the leaders wanted it to. In the name of communism, Stalin killed at least 20 million. Mao, 70 million. Adolf Hitler was inspired by the atheist Friedrich Nietzsche's Darwinian concept of the Übermensch, the Superman, humanity's next evolutionary step. He justified the killing of 10 million, saying that the final solution was simply removing those who were hindering humanity's evolution. He employed an entire army of science-minded killers who believed that it was right and good to rid the world of human weeds, as they called the Jews, Slavs, homosexuals, the infirm, and anyone whose politics didn't align with the Nazis. It takes a colossal ignorance of history to neglect this. Yet scoffers ignore the facts because they destroy their premise that atheism has the moral high ground. An even more personal note here. When I've shared this at other times and places, I've had pushback from scoffers. But when I've challenged their challenge, asking them to state whether either my facts or reasoning are in error, they are unable to. Not liking what you hear isn't a cause to dismiss it. As calculated by historical evidence, the Crusades, Inquisition, and witch trials killed about 200,000 in all over a period of 500 years. Adjusting for population growth, that would have been about 1 million in today's terms. That's a mere 1% of the total killed by Stalin, Mao, and Hitler, and they did it in just a few decades. So let's keep the Crusades, as brutal as they were, and as utterly contrary to the nature and teaching of Christ as they were, in the proper historical perspective. No, I am not justifying the Crusades. They were totally, completely wrong. To turn the cross into a sword and slay with it is blasphemous and deserves loud repudiation by the church. But let's not forget that the Crusaders were human beings with motives not unlike our own. Those motives were mixed and often in conflict. The word crusade comes from taking the cross after the example of Christ. That's why on the way to the Holy Land, the Crusaders wore the cross on their breast, and on the way home, they wore it on their back. But the vast majority of those who went crusading were illiterate, even most of the nobles. They weren't taught the Bible as Christians are today. People throughout Europe thought that salvation rested in the church and was doled out by priests at the direction and discretion of the Pope. So, if the Pope said that crusaders were doing God's work, they were believed. When priests broadcast that dying in the holy cause of a crusade meant that they would bypass purgatory and gain immediate access to heaven, thousands grabbed the nearest weapon and set off. For Urban and the popes who followed him, the Crusades were a new type of war, a holy war. Augustine had laid down the principles of a just war centuries before. Those principles were: a holy war was to be conducted by the state. Its purpose was the vindication of justice, meaning the defense of life and property. And its code called for respect for non-combatants, civilians, that is, and prisoners. While these principles were originally adopted by the Crusaders when they set out on their first campaign, they tended to evaporate in the heat of the ordeal of the journey and the brutality of battle. The Crusades ignited horrible attacks on Jews. Even fellow Christians were not exempt from rape and plunder. incredible atrocities befell the Muslim foe. As the Crusades progressed, occasional voices were lifted calling into question the propriety of such movements and their ultimate value. At the end of the 12th century, the abbot Joachim complained that the popes made Crusades a pretext merely for their own advancement. Humbert de Romigny, the general of the Dominicans, in making out a list of matters to be handled at the Council of Lyon in 1274, was obliged to refute no less than 7 well-known objections to the Crusades. They included these. Number 1, it was stated that it was contrary to the precepts of the New Testament to advance religion by the sword. Number 2, it was said that Christians may defend themselves but have no right to invade the lands of another. Number 3, it's wrong to shed the blood of unbelievers. Number 4, the disasters of the Crusades prove that they were contrary to the will of God. Christians in Europe during the 14th and 15th centuries were to face far more pressing problems than a conquest of the Holy Land. So while there was still an occasional call for a crusade, it fell on deaf ears. Erasmus, writing at the close of the Middle Ages, made an appeal for the preaching of the gospel as a way to deal with the Muslims. He said that the proper way to defeat the Turks was by conversion, not annihilation. Writing, he said, quote, "Truly, it is not meet to declare ourselves Christian men by killing very many, but by saving very many. Not if we send thousands of heathen people to hell, but if we make many infidels Christian. Not if we cruelly curse and excommunicate, but if we, with devout prayers and with our hearts, desire their health and pray unto God to send them better minds," unquote. The long-range results of 2 centuries of crusading were not impressive. If the main purpose of the Crusaders was to win the Holy Land, to check the advance of Islam, and heal the schism between the Eastern and Western churches, well, they failed spectacularly. For a time, the 4 Crusader kingdoms held a beachhead on the Mediterranean coast of the Holy Land. In them, 3 semi-monastic military orders formed: the Templars, whose first headquarters were on the site of the Old Temple of Jerusalem; the Hospitallers, also known as the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, originally founded to care for the sick and the wounded; and the Germanic Teutonic Knights. These orders combined monasticism and militarism and had as their aims the protection of pilgrims, also perpetual war against Muslims. They fielded 500 armed knights. Their great castles guarded the roads and passes against attack. And for 2 centuries, the Templars in their white robes decorated with a red cross, the Hospitallers in black robes emblazoned with the white Maltese cross, and the Teutonic Knights in white robes with black crosses, well, they were common sights in Crusader states across Europe. While the Crusades seemed to us today a terrible betrayal of biblical Christianity, we must bring the historian's mindset to them and consider them against the times in which they occurred. This doesn't excuse them, but it does make them a bit more understandable. European society of the Middle Ages was irredeemably warlike. In feudal Europe, the whole economic and social system depended on the maintenance of a military, that is, knights, permanent professional soldiers. By necessity, due to the cost involved, noblemen whose only profession was fighting. The city-states of Italy were frequently at war with each other. In Spain, a line drawn across the map for centuries by the presence of the Muslim Moors. So even if Christians had wanted to create a peaceful society, it would have been socially and practically difficult to do so. One way of dealing with this was to idealize warfare. That is, you know, casting war as a contest between good and evil. In the development of the idea of the Christian knight, there was an attempt to give the spiritual battle a corresponding literal application. The knight was a soldier of Christ, a warrior for good. At a time when priests and monks were deemed the only ones able to make contact with God, the Crusades were a way for lay people to enter the spiritual realm and rack up some serious points with God. Priests fought the good fight by prayer. Now laymen could fight as well, with a sword or a mace, or if that's all they could afford, a pitchfork, until they got to the real battlefield where they hopefully then could find a more suitable weapon. So it was important for medieval Christians to convince themselves the war they were fighting was justified. A sophisticated system of identifying a just war developed. Augustine had said a good deal about this, explaining that someone whose property or land was stolen is entitled to get it back, but that this was different from warfare designed to enlarge one's territory. The underlying principle was that reasonable force could be used to maintain order. The late 11th century saw the arrival of a new thought, not Augustine's just war, but the concept of a holy war, one God called his people to fight to restore Christian control of the Holy Land. This was war which could not only be regarded as justified and the sins committed in the course of it forgiven, but meritorious. God would reward those who fought it. Guibert of Nogent, in his book The Acts of God Through the Franks, explained how to identify a holy war. It wasn't motivated by the desire for fame, money, or conquest. Its motive was the safeguarding of liberty, the defense of the state, and the protection of the church. He considered this kind of warfare a valid alternative to being a monk. This idea so engaged the medieval mind that as the 12th century wound on, it had to be discouraged, as it seemed everyone began seeing knighthood in combat as spiritual warfare. And bullies have always been able to villainize those they want to victimize. They justify their brutality by calling it a divine mission. Priests and theologians emphasized not all fighting came under the same umbrella. Crusading, though, well, that was special. Of course, one of the major tenets of Muslim theology is jihad, holy war, to spread the faith. And despite loud protests by some today, the fact remains that the Islam that Muhammad taught, which of course is the true Islam, endorses jihad. How else did it spread from its desert base in Arabia, across the Middle East, North Africa, and all the way into Europe in such a short time, if not but by the power of the scimitar? I find it interesting that modern Muslims decry the Crusades when it was their own bloody campaigns that took the lands the Crusaders sought to, what? That's right, reclaim. How could they reclaim something that wasn't claimed and conquered by Muslims previously? I say it again, this in no way justifies the Crusades. They're an indefensible period of church history that stands as a dark stain. But let's be clear, if they're a stain on church history, the conquests by the Muslims that predate the Crusades are just as dark.